It is Tuesday, August 28th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, U.S. Secretary of Defense James Mattis pays tribute to the late Senator John McCain.
Senator John McCain was a man who served his country.
How will trade proceed in North America following this week's announcement of a new agreement between the United States and Mexico? We'll get some perspectives. And a glass harpist in a Washington suburb performs for audiences with glasses filled with water. It's all ahead. Tributes continue to pour in for the late Senator John McCain, who died Saturday of cancer at the age of 81. Among them, Defense Secretary James Mattis, who spoke of McCain at a Pentagon briefing Tuesday.
My deepest condolences to his family for the loss of a man who represented all the ideals America stands for. Senator John McCain was a man who served his country honorably as a naval officer, as a defiant prisoner of war, standing with his brothers in arms until all returned home together, and as a leader in Congress, including as chairman of the Senate Armed Service Committee.
I'm joined by VOA correspondent Carla Babb, who's at the Pentagon. Well, Carla, even though McCain left the military many years ago after his imprisonment during the Vietnam War, and he went on to a very distinguished political career, he's remembered fondly by the military.
Absolutely. He was a big proponent of military funding. He made countless trips to Iraq and Afghanistan, all over the world, to visit men and women on the front lines. And so when he passed away, it was not just a brief moment in time when he served his country. He was a prisoner of war, and he came back, and he continued to stand for the Department of Defense. And so it was very fitting, I felt, for Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis to make that statement at the top of what is considered a very rare briefing by the Secretary and Chairman Dunford, the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, today.
Well, during the briefing, Secretary Mattis also commented on U.S. military exercises with South Korea, and he said he indicated that they're going ahead.
He did. He said, and I'm quoting him, he says, "We have no plans at this time to suspend any more exercises." He explained that the exercises, the large exercises that were suspended earlier, were done so on good faith, as a good faith gesture to North Korea, so that the diplomats could do their job, because he says that his job as the defense secretary is to support the diplomats. He says that, you know, as it goes now, though, there are no plans for future suspensions of any more exercises, and so the next major exercises that are coming up would be early next year. He also said, though, I should point out that exercises were suspended, but they were the large exercises. He said that the smaller exercises had been ongoing this entire time, so the United States and its allies are still ready to fight if needed.
Well, what did Secretary Mattis, he also spoke about Syria and Russia and the way forward. What did he have to say about that?
He did. The Secretary was actually very forceful coming out against Russia and its role in Syria. He said, what have they done other than prop up Assad, who has been bringing mayhem and murdering his people? He said point blank, the Russians have no business inside of Syria, and that the United States wants to do three things in Syria. He says, first, they want to defeat ISIS. There is still a pocket of ISIS fighters in the Euphrates River Valley, and he wants to make sure that they are gone and that that place is secure. He said, then we're in the process now of training locals to take over the security situation. And he says, after those two things are done, it's up to the Geneva process to bring about peace and to allow the Syrian people to oust Assad and come up with a government that is their government that can move forward. And he said that Russia and Iran have been preventing that from happening by propping up Assad. They also discussed some of the numbers of Islamic State fighters in Iraq and Syria. There have been reports recently that there could be as many as 30,000 Islamic State fighters in Iraq and Syria. Chairman Dunford pushed back when I asked him that question. He goes, Carla, you know, I believe in some statistics and I do not believe in some statistics with regard to the numbers that you just gave me. I've seen those reports, but I don't have high confidence in those particular numbers.
Yeah, because that has been quite controversial about the numbers of them.
That's right. In December, I had reported from the spokesperson in Baghdad telling us that less than 3,000 Iraqi or Islamic State fighters remained in Iraq and Syria. And so these numbers had kind of been out of the blue, and they are actually what was quoted during the height of Islamic State. So Chairman Dunford did point out that there are pockets of fighters everywhere. He did not say that the fight is over. He said there is, yes, a lot of work to be done, but I would not put confidence in those numbers.
All right. Thanks very much, Carla. That's VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. Pakistan expresses a desire to move on despite a row concerning a U.S. phone call. Rebel leader Machar in South Sudan refuses to sign a peace deal. 14 jailed Cambodian opposition activists are freed. And Japan says North Korea still poses an imminent threat. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
We humans have a built-in need to fit into society and be accepted by our peers and the people we love. Past research has found that the need to seek approval of others was noticeable in 4- and 5-year-old children. A new study from Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia, suggests children are already aware that they're being judged and want the approval of others by 24 months. To make their findings, the researchers conducted 4 experiments with 144 children between 14 and 24 months old. In one experiment, the researchers taught toddlers how to operate a toy robot by remote control and then watched them manipulate the toy with either a neutral expression or just didn't pay attention and pretended to read. The children showed more inhibition and embarrassment when being watched rather than when they weren't being watched. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, a Red Square protest and the seeds of Russian democracy turn 50. Canada Tuesday rejoined North American free trade talks after the U.S. and Mexico reached a preliminary bilateral trade deal Monday to replace the 24-year-old North American free trade agreement, NAFTA. President Donald Trump, a fierce critic of NAFTA, he said caused a trade imbalance and moved jobs and industries to Mexico. He welcomed the breakthrough in a process that lasted more than a year.
It's a big day for trade, big day for our country. A lot of people thought we'd never get here.
They used to call it NAFTA. We're going to call it the United States-Mexico Trade Agreement. And we'll get rid of the name NAFTA. It has a bad connotation because the United States was hurt very badly by NAFTA for many years. And now it's a really good deal for both countries. This is something that's very special for our manufacturers and for our farmers from both countries, for all of the people that work for jobs. It's also great trade, and it makes it a much more fair bill. As far as Canada is concerned, we haven't started with Canada yet. We wanted to do Mexico and see if that was possible to do. And we'll start negotiation. And if they'd like to negotiate fairly, we'll do that. You know, they have tariffs of almost 300% on some of our dairy products, so we can't have that. We're not going to stand for that.
Trump threatened tariffs on Canadian-built vehicles entering the U.S. market if an agreement could not be reached. Trump spoke with Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau by phone Monday, and they agreed to continue productive conversations. While Trump indicated he will submit the deal with Mexico by week's end unless a breakthrough is reached with Canada, University of Ottawa Public and International Affairs Associate Professor Patrick LeBlond tells International Edition's Victor Beatty, for Canada, the key is what concessions the U.S. is seeking.
We know that President Trump talked about supply management in the dairy sector in Canada. saying that on some products, Canada imposes very high tariffs. But again, we know that both Canada and the U.S. protect certain sectors of their agricultural economy. There's a big question there as to what will it take to get to a deal. And I think that's what Foreign Minister Freeland, who's going to be in Washington tomorrow, is going to try to find out.
The sense when these negotiations began about a year ago was that the hardest part would be agreeing with Mexico. But in fact, the U.S. and Mexico agreed first.
For my part, I would say that Canada is probably okay with what was agreed to. I would think that they were consulted and informed of what was going on, at least by the Mexicans, so that this would not be a big surprise. The Mexicans seem to always have believed that they were negotiating for a trilateral deal, so it would be odd that they would not have kept the Canadians informed and consulted them and tried to see, okay, is this okay if we agree to this? I think the Canadians were not completely cut off from this negotiation.
Patrick, a spokesman for Canada's Foreign Minister, Chrystia Freeland, said Canada continues to negotiate but will only sign a new agreement that's good for the country.
It makes no sense for a country to sign a deal if it's not going to be a better deal than what they have now. And that's what the Canadian side has been saying since the beginning. Canada said, look, we have a deal now. We want to make it better. We want to modernize it. And we will only agree to a new NAFTA if we think it is a better deal overall and certainly a better deal for Canada. Otherwise, we'll just keep what we have.
Duncan Wood, director of the Wilson Center's Mexico Institute, tells Victor Beatty the benefits are both financial and political for Mexico.
Mexico has increased investor confidence. The markets have already reacted positively to the fact that Mexico signed this bilateral deal with the United States. And I think that that was the primary goal that Mexico had, both in terms of the outgoing president, Enrique Peña Nieto, and the incoming president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador. Both of them wanted to have this issue resolved before the transition of power. Enrique Peña Nieto really wanted to have this done so that he could say that this was an achievement and that he was leaving Mexico in a sound state. But there's still a lot of work to do. You know, we have a resolution to the major issues that Mexico had with the United States and vice versa. But now that we throw Canada back into the mix, I think it's going to be a very interesting equation because Canada, of course, has a very different set of problems with the United States.
Was this a true compromise between Mexico and the U.S.?
I think it was a compromise. The United States was willing to be flexible on certain issues, in particular on investor-state dispute settlement. Also, of course, on the question of the sunset clause. The United States on regional content for automobiles set out with a very high target of 85% North American content, 40% U.S. content, and has finally compromised with 75% regional content and then 40% of content coming from workers who make $16 an hour or more, meaning they're employed either in the United States or Canada. You know, both sides have given up something. I think it's a deal that, you know, both sides can live with. Now we have to see if this can be trilateralized because one of the great fears, I think, amongst many of us analysts is that if Canada, for some reason, doesn't come to an agreement with the United States and Mexico, if this remains a bilateral deal, then Mexico is potentially vulnerable. We've seen throughout these negotiations how Canada and Mexico have really backed each other up. They've supported each other at difficult times. In particular, Canada refused to go the bilateral route early on. And now we've seen, of course, that Mexico has chosen to go the bilateral route, at least to resolve their issues. And in today's press conference in Mexico City, Foreign Secretary Luis Videgaray said that whilst he wants Canada to be part of the trilateral deal, if for some reason Canada can't come to an agreement with the United States, then Mexico will go ahead with a bilateral deal.
Duncan Wood said President Donald Trump, who has vowed to submit either a bilateral or trilateral deal to Congress by Friday, needs a quick agreement with Canada, perhaps more than Canada needs it, because of the upcoming U.S. elections in November. 50 years ago this month, the then Soviet Union shocked the world by invading its supposed communist ally, Czechoslovakia. But back in Moscow, the Soviet invasion also prompted a protest at home that would become a seminal moment in now Russia's human rights and pro-democracy movement. From Moscow, Charles Maines reports.
In August 1968, Soviet tanks stormed into communist Czechoslovakia. The Soviet government assured its citizens the troops were there to provide friendly assistance. But the invasion triggered despair among Russian pro-democracy activists, who in the crackdown in Prague saw a harbinger for further repression at home.
There was a hope that Czechoslovakia will start some reforms, and these reforms will help not only Czechoslovakia, but to us in Russia, if they will stick.
Pavel Litvinov, then a 28-year-old physicist, was one of eight Russians who secretly headed to Moscow's Red Square to express support for their Czech and Slovak comrades. As the Kremlin clocks chimed noon, they unfurled a banner that read simply, "For your freedom and ours." The demonstration lasted just minutes before they were beaten and detained by police.
There was no question. I expected 7 years of labor camp, like many of my friends, for so-called anti-Soviet agitation and propaganda.
Litvinov was sentenced to 5 years hard labor in a Siberian mining camp. He later immigrated to the United States. The other demonstrators faced a similar fate or were committed to Soviet psychiatric wards. But it was a defining moment for the Russian pro-democracy and dissident movement to come.
It wasn't for nothing that people went to prison or were exiled, because it wasn't a simply one-off demonstration that everyone soon forgot about. It resonated widely.
Yet today, polls show nearly half of all Russians are unaware of the 1968 invasion. Fewer still, the Red Square protest it inspired.
People 35 and under don't really know about these events, but it mattered internationally. From that moment on, the Soviet Union started to disappear and people started to become freer.
The Soviet Union is long gone, but state pressure against opposition figures and government critics in Russia are hardly a thing of the past. In the Kremlin's proxy war in Ukraine and rollback on political freedoms, family members of the Red Square demonstrators see parallels with 1968.
If then it was a story about how Czechoslovakia had freedoms and lost it under the tanks, today it's a story about how Russians gained freedom and then lost it or are losing it. And again, there are tanks. Only not on Red Square. They're now in Ukraine and in Crimea.
And at a ceremony to mark the 1968 protest on Red Square, Litvinov called for the release of current-day political prisoners, even as police moved in on two demonstrators. A reminder that 50 years on, it is still limits more than freedoms that define the times. Charles Maines for VOA News, Moscow.
This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
This is International Edition. Musician Jamie Turner chose an unconventional career path by becoming a glass harpist. He plays music with glasses filled with water. He uses his fingertips to rub the rim of the glasses to create a range of musical tones. VOA's Deborah Block watched Turner play the glass harp in Alexandria, Virginia, where people seemed to be awestruck by the sounds he created.
Glass harpist Jamie Turner spreads his music to visitors in Alexandria, Virginia, with this popular classical tune, Ode to Joy, by Beethoven. Turner has been showcasing his music here for more than 25 years. A lot of tourists come to visit this historic town outside Washington, many from overseas.
I've never heard something like this before. I think it's fantastic.
I think it's like a really different way to play music, and it's seems difficult to do it and to remember like which cup sounds which way.
Turner, who is 78 years old, began playing the glass harp 50 years ago. Although he also plays other instruments, the glass harp is his passion.
The instrument that really caught my imagination was the sound of glass when I heard my dad playing a glass around the dining room table when I was 6 years old.
Turner sets up 60 ordinary stemmed glasses on a soundboard, anchored with rubber bands, which keeps them from breaking. He tunes each glass to a different pitch by filling them with distilled water. As Turner rubs his dampened fingers around the rims, the smaller bowls produce higher pitches, while the larger ones resonate deeper tones.
The more water is in the glass, the lower the pitch.
Some visitors enjoyed the opportunity to play the biggest glasses.
I didn't know glass was actually like an instrument. I didn't know it made that much sound.
The glass harp was popular in the 1700s, when classical composers like Mozart wrote music specifically for the instrument. Turner plays all kinds of music, including this popular Chinese tune.
Very amazing.
The glass harpist has been able to make a living as a performer and has even played with top U.S. orchestras. But with so few people playing the glass harp, Turner is hoping the next generation will keep the instrument alive.
I think it's gaining in popularity. A lot of people have seen me on YouTube, and I'm very pleased that it will continue. People can't help but smile when they hear it.
Deborah Block, VOA News, Alexandria, Virginia.
A very popular sight there.
That is our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The overarching strategy of the United States towards Russia is to deter Russia from confrontation by raising the costs of its aggression. This includes strengthening the military, economic, and political foundations of American power. Our Russia policy proceeds from the recognition that, to be effective, U.S. diplomacy must be backed by military power, said Assistant Secretary for European and Eurasian Affairs Wes Mitchell in congressional testimony. To that end, we have reversed years of cuts to the defense budget, begun the process of recapitalizing the U.S. nuclear arsenal, requested close to $11 billion for the European Deterrence Initiative, and worked within NATO to bring about more than $40 billion in new European defense spending. Through diplomatic expulsions and targeted sanctions, the U.S. has worked in close coordination with European allies to degrade Russian President Vladimir Putin's ability to conduct aggression by imposing costs on the Russian state, as well as on the oligarchs close to Putin who helped to sustain the state. Even as the U.S. has imposed unprecedented penalties for Russian aggression, said Dr. Mitchell, we have been clear that the door to dialogue is open. In Syria, Dr. Mitchell said, we created de-escalation channels to avoid collisions between our forces. In Ukraine, we have maintained an effort under Ambassador Kurt Volker to provide the means by which Russia can live up to its commitments under the Minsk agreements. But in all these areas, it is up to Russia to take the next step. The U.S. has bolstered frontline states in Europe. In Ukraine and Georgia, said Assistant Secretary Mitchell, we lifted restrictions on the acquisition of defensive weapons. In the Balkans, we have played a hands-on role in resolving the Greece-Macedonia name dispute and engaging with Serbia and Kosovo to propel the EU-led dialogue. From the Caucasus to Central Europe, we are promoting energy diversification, fighting corruption, and competing for hearts and minds. Russia foments and funds both sides of controversial causes in an effort to destabilize societies and governments. Countering such threats in both its overt and covert forms is among the highest priorities of the U.S. government and our NATO allies. The United States is committed to countering Russian aggression and malign activities. At the same time, the door to dialogue is open. Our respective national security advisors have met in Geneva. Should Russia choose to take steps toward a constructive path?
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.